FMCG or tech?
Tech.
Brand strategy or brand identity?
Close, identity.
Long-term or short-term?
Long-term.
In-house or outsourced?
Outsourced.
Traditional or innovative?
Innovative, obviously.
Customer first or product first?
I'm going to say product first.
Proactive or reactive?
Proactive.
Print or billboards?
Close. Billboards.
Rat or fish?
Fish.
Thank you. JT, welcome.
Thank you. I'll take fish.
That just came to me, please. Yeah, I don't know why you go for rat. Why would you go for rat? Mate, thank you so much. I wouldn't usually do this, but I'm going to do this because I think it's important. But you are, I would say, my first ever mentor from back in the day. We met in the Valandry. You were the first ever CEO that I met. I was a young, spunky 21-year-old. I could not believe that you took the meeting. And I was, oh, my God. And I was there in my little blazer and shit. And we sat in the Valandry and I just word vomited at you. And I actually wanted to say thank you. Before we go into this, I wanted to say, thank you for taking that meeting. You were the first ever person to make me feel like I had potential to be talented.
Yeah.
I don't think you made me feel like I was talented. I think you just went, keep on going, man. Like, whatever you're doing, like, keep on going. So thank you. I want to say thank you for that.
Oh, that's great. I mean, my experience of that meeting was similar. I remember seeing this incredibly fresh-faced, enthusiastic, incredibly good-looking, so dreamy, I couldn't take my eyes. I was kind of like, oh my gosh. And I think what you put, maybe you didn't appreciate, was we had a, you know, real desperate need at that point to potentially find a new creative partner, either from within or externally. And what I really needed at that moment was someone that was just going to come with a completely fresh take on it and not necessarily bring all of the, well, this is how the runners and riders work and, you know, this is what we've got to do.
Mm.
So I really appreciated that. And I think that's what kind of glued that moment together. Was I was like, this is exactly what I'm looking for, is a completely fresh set of eyes on this. So I don't know what the lesson of that is. Maybe it's like everyone's got their own needs coming in and whatever, but you know, I think I got the same, I had the same reaction to you, which was, thank God there's somebody new, somebody fresh is going to take a completely new look at this and support me. So yeah.
Well, thank you. I remember having deep imposter syndrome before, during, and after. So, yeah, you were accommodating for that, and thank you. I remember going back to the agency, and I was like, yeah, they've invited us to like go to the agency. And like recruiters at that point were never allowed to go into like the floor of an agency. You get pushed into a room and be like, yeah, who are these fucking estate agents? Don't talk about them.
I can remember there was a funny bit towards the end where I think, so this would be like the brief for, I think it might have been ECD maybe, of the company at the time. And towards the end, it was something to the effect of, so I can have this brief exclusively.
Please, I think you said that.
I can have this brief exclusively. I thought, yeah, okay, because I was thinking I really need this guy to take a look at it. I want this fresh perspective. So, yeah, I guess we've just agreed it's yours for a bit.
But that, and I remember I remember that feeling, because I'd never had an exclusive ECD brief in my life. I remember bouncing out of there like, wow, placed it as well. Mr. Will Thacker.
Indeed, yeah. Wow. Who did brilliant
things. Or the Thacker Attack, as you used to call him.
Yeah.
Well, look, thank you. I'm going to dive straight into this, because I think I want to cover your the story of Ann Rising, or 18 Feet Ann Rising, as it was called then. But before we do, we're going to start with our traditional question, which is, JT, who was the first person that made you feel like you had talent?
Professionally, it was a lady called Miriam Jordan Keane, who at the time was, I think, probably head of account management or similar, head of one of the groups. They had these big group systems at Saatchi & Saatchi. I think the group was called Radetzky. They were so big at this point. It was almost like mini agencies within the Saatchi & Saatchi infrastructure. And I think she was head of one of those. And she gave me a fiercely intelligent woman, incredibly very powerful presence, but also unbelievably warm.
Mm.
So she was this mix of steel and love and openness, and she was also incredibly funny. And she did a few things. One was she described her job. She said, oh, look, you know, on a bad day I love advertising, and on a good day I can't believe they actually pay me to do this job. And when you're looking into an industry trying to figure out what you want to do, that was just, it was like, wow, you know, whatever that is, I want to be part of that. So that was the first thing, was she's bridged the universe of what advertising was and helped me see that actually it could be something for me. And then the other part of it was, she gave me a break and said, you come and do some work experience. And it was unpaid and kind of a little bit unofficial, but I got up there and just made myself as useful as I possibly could, which was obviously not all that useful, and mostly hovering around. But then we would do meetings and catch ups. And in those meetings, it was as if you were shoulder to shoulder with her. And there was no question that you were on some sort of learning journey. It was almost like, okay, you're here, you can do it. Now almost prove me wrong. And I think there's a huge clue in the way she did that. And we used to talk about her as sprinkling sort of magic dust on people. She had she has an amazing way with people to make them feel amazing about themselves. And that's what she'd do. And I think she did it by sort of saying, well, you're there, let's start there. Mm. You're there, you can do it. Now, you know, what do we need to know? What do we need to do? It was never like, okay, so here's how it's going to work. Here. Yeah. So the difference is, rather than an expectation to live up to, she almost just gave you a possibility to live into. And that was her real skill. And so I'm incredibly grateful to have had that chance, because sort of almost from the get-go, I had an early stage sponsor that was giving me a possibility to live into, rather than, okay, here's how you're going to do it, and here's how you're going to, you know, here's how you get to the next step. And it's a huge lesson for bringing people on. There's a conductor called Ben Zander, and he's got a great speech online about this that I think is quite well known in the teaching community. And he's a conductor, and he depends upon the power of the orchestra in order to create, you know, the outcomes the audience wants to hear. So that's kind of one of his things, is it's not about me, it's about the orchestra and how that all comes together. And when he goes in, he goes in to teach others how to teach, and he says, look, on day one, all these music students turn up, and they're, you know, they're hugely accomplished, and they've studied and practiced to get into this music school. And I see them sitting next to each other, and they're all kind of looking at each other going, you know, am I better than that person? Is this person better than me? You know, am I going to cope with this? And he says to them, okay, here's some good news. You've all got an A, you've all passed, you've all got the with a distinction. And now what I'd like you to do is to write a letter to that person. And most people think, okay, I'll write the letter to the person, and oh, I know, I get it, I'm going to then, you know, be the person in the letter, that kind of thing. But that's not it. The twist is, he says, I then teach the person in the letter, not the person in front of me. And it's that same thing, which is, I'm going to assume the person gets there and assume the person to be at the top of their game. Mm. And that's the person I'm going to, that's how I'm going to work with that person as if they're already there.
Wow.
So it's quite, and I think that was kind of Miriam's thing. She was like, oh yeah, no, if I'm talking to you, it's because I'm assuming you're there. And the rest will work out. Yeah.
She can see you in the future and is like, I can see you, I'm going to get you there, kind of thing.
She put you in a movie called Becoming You.
I love that.
Yeah.
So, okay, you're a CEO now of Van Rising, which is an agency that's been through so many different chapters and stories. Yeah. But before you became a CEO, you were what would be called a suit or somebody in client services. What was that role? Why would you enjoy doing that role? And why were you good at that thing?
So I was a very proud suit, proud of the role, proud of the job.
Why?
Mainly because I had a really specific playbook, and I think it's partly because I have great empathy for the journey that creative people go through to create. It's partly because I was sort of half a creative background myself. My dad was a sign writer, my mum was an entrepreneur, and I'm a sort of like odd mix of the two things spliced together. And my playbook, if you like, I was always surrounded by incredibly talented creative people that really knew what they were doing. And I very quickly, within a couple of years, managed to get into, you know, some of the top agencies. And those agencies just had they'd amassed a department of talent that really knew what it was doing in all ranges, at all levels. And so I kind of figured out, whenever I was speaking to creative people, it would always make a ton of sense to me. Like, oh, what they're saying actually makes an awful lot of sense, that we should go in that direction. And everything else always seemed a bit of a distraction to me. It was quite a lot of noise. So my playbook was to get onto the field, work out what was going on, see the lie of the land, and almost then to get the ball into the hand of the creative person as quick as you possibly can. Let them run up the field. And when they then hit a barrier, I'll come in behind you like the number eight and we'll push until we go all the way. And so, and that was an incredibly effective strategy to push through great creative work, basically. Make sure you were giving the creative people full autonomy to develop something, whatever they thought was best, and then we'll put that forward and we'll scrummage it and go and kind of sit the same side of the table and go all the way. And I think on balance, you know, it's not for every type of situation, every type of client, but I think on balance it was at that time, you know, it would lead to great results basically, because the company, individuals, clients would get these incredible creative outcomes out of the back of it. And then there'd be situations that didn't really require that and didn't want that. And, you know, once or twice it would kind of lead to a fair bit of collateral damage because it was a fairly uncompromising system.
I can see how that works for the creatives, and I can imagine that eventually the clients will be happy for that. I want to ask about, because we'll move into Amrising, I think it's a really interesting story, but where you've obviously worked at Fallon and some incredible places at a time. Can you think of a moment where you were like, this is the fucking career that I wanted. This is incredible. I'm loving this.
Yeah, it was. Well, I always wanted to start a company, and I knew that from the beginning. And I think, you know, John Clayton, who's one of our backers, says entrepreneurs are born, not made. So I think that's kind of was always in there somewhere. But there was at one point where I thought, oh, maybe I'm not going to. Really? Maybe I found a different idea here. And it was a Adam and Eve DDB. I was somewhere around the account director into board director level. I had an incredible portfolio of clients I was working on. They were all the sort of ruck and drive creative work through method was working great for them. For us, it was all kind of in sync. And I thought I would like to go on and run this company. And that's, yeah, at that moment in time, the combination of support, what I was learning from everyone around me, the opportunities, the matches that we were getting to play, the accolades that we were winning, the ascent of the whole thing was, and the tone, it was really the tone of, I don't know so much about the internals of Adam and Eve DDB today, but I know that cultures don't change very quickly, and it had a tremendously allowing culture whilst also being, the quality standard was just incredibly high.
Mm.
And so again, it was this combination of sort of warmth and standards and belief. And so, yeah, it was, it was an incredible period. And then it started like all these things, you know, particularly in advertising. I don't know loads about football, but it seems to be the only thing that's worse than football. So it goes up and down and left and right. And so it didn't last, but there was a good 3, 4, 5 years, I think, where it was, they're really golden years, you know?
And so making those things golden, you're talking about good work, the people around you, the stuff that you're making. What made that moment burst or balloon burst?
It's a great question. I'm trying to remember what the sequence of events was now. There was really around, it's the company at that point suffered its own crisis of identity. Something had stopped working for it at some level that wasn't visible to everyone on the shop floor, if you like. Mm. And the energy in that place was the very best work, the very best campaigns. And suddenly it felt like the focus was shifting somewhere else. And partly it was, I think, a crisis the industry was experiencing around the arrival of digital coming up into a really significant force. And so the word, it suddenly started to become a conversation about channels.
Mm.
And I think our response to channels was, well, it's just what you're putting in the channels. Don't take your focus off the content. And that was the sort of shift one. Shift two then was, there was a change in name. So Adam and Eve DDB was actually called BMP DDB at that point. And it's BMP was as famous as Adam and Eve. It was known, you know, that was the front end that was known, and the DDB part was...
Mm.
like less known really. And there was some funny things, like it was always in yellow so it wouldn't show up on headed paper and stuff like that. So it was always the quiet kind of group in the background. And because it had done so phenomenally well in London, the group left it alone for the most part. And suddenly globally they decided that it would be neater, corporately neater, just to call everything DDB. And they disbanded all the front parts of the names. And it was amazing how it shouldn't really make any difference. Certainly doesn't make any difference to clients. But somehow it really shifted the energy, and it sort of signaled, we're not going to be about the outcome anymore. We're now going to be about networkness or something else.
Yeah.
And after that, leadership then kind of started to spin. We had some new CEOs arrive. And so somewhere between the loss of what is this about and the lots of changeover in management, it really started to change into something I didn't recognize as much and wasn't as interested in. And so it was at that point, I then looked for the replica of it, and that was at Fallon. Fallon was then, at that point, was then, like, it couldn't get any more hardcore creatively. It was almost like a couple notches even more hardcore. Yeah. I mean, their model was great work at any cost, including the people. You know, it wasn't. Whereas Adam and Eve DDB was definitely the people. I think their thing was kind of like people, product, profit.
Yes. This
kind of, and creativity and humanity were the value. So pretty, it was pretty up there. And Fallon was great work.
Full stop.
If everything has to, you know, yeah, whatever else we do, you know. I kind of like that about it. It was even more uncompromising, you know.
Where was this in the timeline of Gorilla and Balls?
Just after. So I joined just after. I arrived in the September. I was leaving in the June, landed in the September, and Gorilla was that June or July or something.
Wow.
So it just...
So the hottest agency probably of a decade at that exact moment.
100%. I mean, one thing you can time by my CV almost exactly as I arrive at the peak. And then you get about another 30%. And that was the same.
What happened, JT, basically?
Basically that, you can mark it. It's like, oh, we've got 30% left, guys. Yeah. It's landed.
So that was a similar story, right? They get bought by a publicist, or the deal was happening around that time.
Yeah, exactly.
So similar to a DDB sort of situation. Publicist buys it. The gut's kind of stripped out. I mean, I think Fallon is now like a tiny little 20-person thing within Leo Burnett somewhere now.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was what, like a 300-person business producing?
It wasn't that big, actually. Yeah. It was, I mean, its footprint globally and stature and impact was, there may not have been anything bigger. I mean, partly because of the size of the channels at that point. But, I mean, it would have to be in the at least the top three. I think it goes number one probably in that for that period, not only here in London, in the UK, and then just it's the recognition it was receiving. And people were kind of, what is happening in that building?
Yeah.
But it went from, I think I landed at where they were around 65, 70. They had previously been 40 for a while. So right. It was really boutique, really cool. Everybody knew each other really well. And that was Fallon really 1.0. And I was part of a relatively short-lived 2.0, where they were having to bring lots more people in. They were having to absorb other cultures. You know, I was coming from a very different culture, which they were very sensitive about and alive to. Like, you're coming from a place that's very calm and a place that people are extremely nice to each other. And sometimes we think they're nice to the detriment of the outcomes and the work. And here we're not frightened to have we're not frightened to get into conflict here. Yeah. How are you going to cope with conflict was kind of the, you know, so they were having to absorb different styles coming in to sort of take it to the next level. And I think when I left, it was at about 180.
Wow. So this is the birthplace of 18 Feet and Rising.
Yes.
Which, yeah. If I remember rightly, yeah. Are you exactly 6 foot?
Dude, I'm the smallest of them.
Right.
That's the hilarious thing is I managed to find two others who are a bit taller and we pumped it up to 18 feet as a roll up, basically.
Because you had the two
with
other
Matt
founders.
6'4".
Yes. Oh, so yeah. I always said that you were all, so the three founders, I always said, oh, it's because they were all exactly 6 foot each.
Oh,
but that's
great.
Not the case. It was a collective height. So I gave you a bit of an increase there.
100%.
You're
yeah.
Welcome.
So I'm like 5'10", maybe 5'9" and a half, depending on what shoes I've got on. so yeah, Matt was 6'4". I actually think, to be fair, Tim was also about my height. So between the three of us, we...
You made it.
It felt like we were, okay, cool.
So let's do the glory moment, I guess. You know, similarly, like we spoke about, I feel like Fallon and, well, sorry, DDB was the moment for you. What was the glory moment of chapter one of 18 Feet and Rising? And actually, better question, what problem were you trying to solve and why did you launch it originally?
It was really straightforward. We wanted to be the new Fallon.
Right.
And the new HHCL, the new mother, you can, there's a company that will launch in a particular decade, usually around the beginning of the decade. And by the end of that decade, it is the unquestioned creative agitator, creative standard. It therefore normally has, it's normally the most desired place to work. It's then desired by clients, a certain type of client. I don't think, by the way, that companies with those positionings have the answer for all clients, and that's sort of the illusion. But they have the answer for a very specific section of clients, and that makes it all kind of click, and the wheel sort of goes round. And we couldn't see that coming through. And in fact, we were proven wrong because we saw Adam and Eve launch, and it's, you know, we thought that was sort of very middle of the road. We thought it was, oh, this is like, they're kind of like prog rock or something, and we wanted punk, like we wanted to be right out there. I remember drawing this chart that was creatively led, corporately led and time. And I suppose it's pretty obvious when you think about it, but over time it sort of drifts from top right to bottom left as companies mature and they get bigger, and you know, they will inevitably start to focus on efficiency and consolidation and things like that. And our contention was, well, what's happening right at that top right corner, the really, you know, the outliers that are right over the edge, that utterly uncompromising, pulling together the creative talent that, you know, is there to be unleashed, finds tremendous support there to do things that no one else is going to do, and then really shake the whole thing up. And I think I just had like the plot of the axis entirely wrong, for where the industry was. Actually, it turned out Adam and Eve were at the top right, and we were somewhere on some other axis, you know, that in some ways really struggled to find market fit then. And it's part of a number of changes that are then going on in terms of digital and where that's going and things like that, but also what types of clients needed advertising, and it turned out to be retailers and so on and so forth. So there was a whole knock-on effect of where the creative tastes were going. But our appetite was for that really quite out there, almost you can't get your head around it type of work that would then eventually settle into something that would have a golden period and extended call. And the chart was also really clear. The further top right you started, the slower your curve then into the second quadrant. And we noticed some companies would never cross over. You know, so you'd have BBH or Wieden & Kennedy, Mother, because their beginnings were so far right. They never really curled over the axis. And that's what we thought, you know, that was the curve we were aiming for. We were coming into a very different era where TV advertising was maturing, I think. You know, we were up for more Drumming Gorillas and whatever was going to come after Drumming Gorillas that people couldn't get their heads around. I mean, it's difficult to remember it now, but that particular piece of work just divided the industry in two, divided marketing in two.
Why?
It was like, do you think it's good or bad? And half, you know, pretty much half were like, this is crazy. This doesn't make any sense. It's not glued to the brand. It's got no long term, you know, there was that camp, and then there was another camp. This is just wonderful. You know, it's exactly what the channels are looking for. It's digital. You know, it was the first example of ads being able to go into YouTube and find almost a home where it made sense for that type of work, you know, and so on and so on. So we thought it was a massive unlock. Like, this is the future. And we just didn't see any cultures starting up around that kind of utterly maniacal, uncompromised feel. So that's what we thought. And so our stated goal at the beginning, we started on the first day of the working day of the decade, 2010. And I said, by the end of the decade, we will be the creative agency of record for that decade.
What did you get right?
We did a lot of really experimental work. And, you know, and in the pitches, there was a couple of years where we really caught the new business market off guard, because we were going into these meetings presenting something that looked a cross between advertising, PR and content. And it was really expansive. These meetings would have like loads of ideas on the wall everywhere, and it would almost come from different directions. And some found that very, same thing as the gorilla, some found that very confusing. Or, I don't understand this. Aren't we supposed to find a strategy? And then everything hinges off the strategy and it's neat and tidy. And others were just very liberated by it. They were like, wow, this is just so refreshing. I don't have to sit and think and wonder what the crack the code of life before we can just start seeing some stuff and kind of get into it. And maybe we could actually just build it by running things.
Yeah.
And so that was, I think, there we really took, you know, we really took the market by storm then initially, because I think people were pretty stuck to, we've unlocked it, here's the key, and the reveal is this, and here is the work. You know, we were like, okay, let's just try that, you know, and that, everyone, that kind of stirred things up. We had a couple of pockets where I think the work, you know, achieved moments where I was thinking, okay, this could get there. Was a couple of Christmas ads, I think, in particular, that were almost antidotes to the John Lewis thing. The culture creatively definitely stood for uncompromising, commitment to doing something different. So I think those things were really good. The things that worked less well for it were the, and we were alive to this, was almost like, almost be careful what clients you win quickly. You know, in the bubble of planning for it, we were almost like no retained clients and nothing too big, so that we can just find our feet, settle in, get a body of work that represents where we're going, and then we can start to find our feet into some of the bigger platforms. But it just wasn't working like that. And, you know, it happened to Adam and Eve as well. They came out the gates and then suddenly plop, 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 it was Halifax and John, you know, and the same thing happened to us. Plop, 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 we suddenly had Virgin and Axe and Abel and Nationwide and these huge 20, 25 million pound accounts for a company that was, you know, 14, 15 months old and we were in our early 30s. It was kind of like we had never been in a C-suite before. We actually really didn't know what we were doing. And so at that board, you know, when those companies that require real boardroom level patience, and we were in a real hurry, you know, to get on to make the work that we wanted to make. And these were very, very grown up clients that required a very long term view. Mm-hmm. And so it was almost like the objective, you know, when they talk about business strategy, you need all the things to link up for you. And it was almost like we had the strategy, we had the people. Technology was kind of, I think actually in the round, we probably missed some of the technology stuff. I remember in the early days, we focused quite a lot on it, but couldn't get anything to ignite. It was that classic, it hadn't moved so far on yet that we could embrace it as a revenue stream, but we could see it was moving away from where we were. It was sort of caught in between the plates of change. But if you don't have, if you're not able to develop the customer base that matches those things, then the whole thing sort of falls apart. And the reality was there just wasn't the demand for that type of company. Mm. And there's a sort of lots and lots of reasons that go around that. But and as the decade went on, it became increasingly clear that that's not what the market was going to require either.
You fired Nationwide.
No, they fired us, and then we got really cross about it and fired them. It was one of those sort of backward forward, I dumped you, who dumped who kind of things, I think. In truth. No, they put us on review. We went on notice. We'd been doing it 4.5 years and it had run its course, you know, as these things do. So it just gets tame kind, which is a very big lurch because we're about 25% dependent on that revenue. You build a lot of systems around those types of clients. Mm-hmm. So you have a set of people and a set of processes, and to some extent it has become part of the culture too. So yeah, it's quite difficult when a quarter of it is then going to have to get rewired. But it had run its course.
I wanted to ask you about that time. I'm not sure if you're... Have you signed anything? Are you allowed to sort of speak about this moment?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Well, probably not, but I mean...
Yeah, fuck it.
Lawyer up, sue me.
Yeah, exactly. We've all been there, man. I want to know, because we had a conversation about this time. So it was a stressful time for you. You'd lost 25% of your revenue, big financial client. And the thing I wanted to talk about was the power of campaign at the time.
Yeah,
and I remember you saying, you know, Campaign, Little Black Book, The Drum, you know, these publications, they really did kind of own the industry at that time. Can you tell me about that moment, or at least like how you came to understand about the news?
Yeah, so there's two parts to this. One is actually putting the company in the place that it needed to be for a set of reasons that I'll come on to. But the other one, I think, is about people's perception of those publications and how they shape things. And I think, to be fair, my own perception of how much those things mattered was over-skewed, partly because they did really matter. I mean, there was no getting around it. That magazine was specifically Campaign. I think it's about 40,000 subscriptions. So it's pretty big. And it lands in the receptions everywhere. So it's quite a poster, that front page. So I think to be fair to myself and that publication at the time, you know, that's not happening now. It's some of the newsletter and things like that. But that visible, physical in the all of these is quite an influential. I mean, you can't really buy that media space, I don't think. You know, it's a bunch of C-suite people coming through the doors all the time, picking it up and putting it back down. So it was your main advertising channel. And everyone was like, oh, no one reads Campaign. I'm like, well, no, but everybody sees it and everybody's, you know, it's visible and it's big. And it's where people take their sense of, you know, what's going up and what's going down. But that was also beginning to change. So we're probably a little bit oversensitive about Campaign. So at that point, Campaign was our affirmation. Like, are we doing well as a company? We're still only 5 years, you know, coming into 5 years. And so we still really looked to them to know how we were doing internally, and our, you know, and our staff and so on and so forth. So we were really glued on how do we look in front of them all the time. And I think that was probably an unhealthy thing to be obsessed with at that point. But anyway, the reality was that we were talking about selling some of the company to an investor, and the pricing on that was very high. And almost simultaneously, I don't know if I've spoken about this, but the first Friday back in 2015, I had two conversations One was at 11 a.m. where an investor slid across the table, the heads of terms, that sort of met all my needs, demands. It was like a, it's like a set of zeros. I couldn't get my, you know, I was like, whoa, this is it. You know, this is incredible. And then I went back to the agency kind of a little bit of a diz, thinking I'm just going to sign that thing straight away, like dope, like we've made, you know. And at 4 o'clock that day, Nationwide popped in and put us on notice. So within the same breath, we were like, oh wow, okay. So then all of a sudden you're thinking, right, well, if this is leaving at the same time we're trying to get this done, we may miss this whole thing.
Wow.
The opportunity, because like deal cycles, you know, are like, they're like planetary moons. They come into focus and then you're going to have to wait for the next cycle to come around, and it might not come around because at that point people lose interest and things start spinning off. And you can go, we watched it happen, like agencies will go into a death spiral. And so my thing was, I've got to prevent, in some ways it was, let's get this deal done, but that really wasn't my priority. My priority was, let's stop this going into a death spiral, because a deal falling through coupled with a 25% loss of revenue, the campaign news kind of fueling that. Yeah, that's a recipe for this is over. And this will just quickly spin down. And at that point, we're 5 years invested into it. Survival salaries, capital in, ups, downs, you're covered in battle scars. And so, yeah, I did everything within my power to present an upward face of 18 Feet and Rising, had a second chapter. We got the deal done in the June, around the time the kind of, we were shaking hands with Nationwide to say goodbye.
Wow.
And yeah.
I want to move on to the end of that, because I realize that I could speak about that story for hours. I want to know about And Rising now.
Yeah.
I noticed that it's not 18 Feet And Rising now.
Yeah.
What did you spot? What happened? And how would you describe And Rising today versus yesterday?
So it's a completely different company today. I mean, first of all, 5'10" left. not a very compelling name.
5'10" left. Let's rebrand.
5'10" and rising. 5'10" and sinking. 6 foot and under. There's kind of, it was all these gags. I think, oh no, we've got to change the name. But there was a lot of reasons for the note. It's a whole shift. Part of it is the founders moving on, chapter two.
Of course.
Part of it is, there was always a thing about And Rising. There was a whole speech around, it's not about the founders, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's a shift to becoming a kind of growth engine, marketing services, investing support partner to scale ups and startups. And we felt really strongly that for that, you'd had to abandon this kind of goofy advertising agency name that was really about, let's go top right, be really, really creative and really out there. So let's have this extremely strange name and a lot of other things that are kind of interesting that just attract all this creative energy. And be a bit more straight on, okay, what are we here for? And what services are we providing? And what value are we creating at to the client partners and the investments that we're making? And so And Rising just seemed a much more straightforward add-on. And it immediately then said, okay, we're no longer going to be an advertising agency trying to go top right creatively. We're now going to become something else, not all yet known, but it's something that's going to be very focused on scale-ups. And it's almost like whatever their needs are, we're going to build out of those needs very slowly. And we knew some of them were advertising because they were taking to TV and outdoor and traditional brand advertising to really scale themselves and take themselves to the next level, be acquired, go IPO. So we knew that that was one of the puzzle pieces and possibly major puzzle piece. It was Sporting Chance, that was the puzzle piece and that's all we would have to do. And then over time, we've gradually realized there's a whole set of other channels we need to be in. We need to have control of the media. We need to be advising on capital investment. We need to be investors ourselves. We need to have a really strong design studio that can build and create brands. And so, yeah, it's all fallen out of almost the client rather than the marketplace. And I guess that was the sort of like, oh great, yeah, wake up as an entrepreneur, here's a clue, why don't we think about the customer? Because they're not that interested whether the industry builds out its creative potential up top. We had assumed there would always be a market for that. And that was kind of, you know, you've got to think forward 10 years, like where is, as far as you can, and kind of assume it will have all changed and that the customers for these things won't necessarily exist. And so really that whole thing about, where's the customer today and where are their needs going, and try to take yourself where their needs are going. Over an industry has a playbook, and the playbook works like this. You start creatively led, you become corporately led. Somewhere along the journey, you either make it and you can come downwards and there's enough cash, or you get acquired and you slide over to the left and leave. That doing it by industry playbook is now not how, we don't really think about the industry anymore. We don't try to do it. We don't try to do anything within the confines of a market definitions as the industry would describe them. What we try to do is just go, right, there's a customer of scale-ups and they have needs. What are those needs and how do we meet them? Because what we definitely see is they're pretty underserved. And the model of being invested in them, that was the other thing we were noticing, was like 30, 40, 50%, 60% of our business now was moving towards taking these brands into advertising for the first time. And then we're getting these tremendous exits.
Mm.
You know, and you kind of see the founders exit and you look at the fees, you're thinking, hang on a second, I've got a different idea here. So anyway, we can be in the cap table. And so end of 2019, we started to introduce investments, which we borrowed from a couple of companies, the design studios that do it in the States, have done it for a lot of direct-to-consumer brands, and began that journey. And that's a journey of building up your credentials in that space. You can't just come out of the blocks and say, hey, we're investors now.
Where does that journey finish, do you think?
It finishes in being part venture capital firm and part marketing services company, glued into a kind of hybrid, either as two, you know, as a kind of a brother and a sister, if you like, or actually more likely as one sort of like can't quite put your finger on it, extremely helpful mess, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it can provide a mix of the capital funding that's needed, the support services that are needed in those early days to make sure that that money goes as far as it possibly can. Because that's one of the things, is that as companies raise and then they burn, depending on what they burn on, they run out of money. And then it either has, you know, to my sort of lunar cycle part, it's either clicking into place at that point or it isn't. And if you run out of money, same thing. You know, it doesn't matter if you've got a great idea, great team, great traction, the game's over. And so burning money on agencies, which are expensive and which are really geared for much bigger clients, is a poor way to use the cash.
I wanted to ask you that, because I think Anne Rising isn't, I wouldn't put this in the kind of typical creative agency top 20 campaign thingy anymore, but I still really value your opinion on that part of the industry, yeah, right? Because you've exited in a way, although you're part of it still.
Yeah.
I want you to make a prediction about the creative industry. Who do we think now, looking ahead, who are going to be the winners and the losers, and what will they look like in 3 years' time in the creative agency landscape?
I think it's already obvious. The ones that are already established and winning will continue to, and the ones that are essentially make up the rump of the commoditized but still cash-rich middle will just get increasingly blurrier and will continue to consolidate. I mean, you talked about Fallon into Leo Bennett and that kind of thing. So that continues to happen. I mean, even today you walk into the door of one of the, let's call them ad agencies, you're likely in that same building going to find the other ad agencies in that group. So I think it's only a matter of time before, and you already have now like a head of, you know, X group creative, they might call it, as the, and they sort of mean all of our ad agencies or whatever that might be. So I think that consolidation continues in the cash rich, but...
What about independents?
I think you get a lot of fragmented indies that, I mean, there's always some market for that because they're small. And so the cost base is quite small. And so you can always eke out, you know, you only need 1% of the market to run your revenue into the millions. And so there will still be that there. I just think it'll be really atomized. And my concern for all of those companies is that they aren't able to build empires of significant impact. So it's lifestyle. It's a lot of retirees. You know, it's a place to, you know, it's sort of better than being a consultant. It's like, let's get a few of us together and we'll, you know, we can wrap this up into something perhaps, you know, higher added. So I think that's good. It's good for the people. It's fun. You're independent. I think it's small scale. But there could be enough in there if you're in a position to retire, for example, or you're less concerned about if the revenue bobs about, that kind of thing. And then I think you'll have, a bit like in the recorded music industry, you'll have Abbey Road, you'll have Metropolis, you'll have the one or two studios that become almost more and more golden as time goes on, and that will be Mother, that will be, you know, to some extent Adam and Evil, the name brands where you know you can go for that type of thing almost get, do you know what I mean? They become the house of that remaining part of that industry, and they get all of the briefs that require that. So whereas before there might be a whole segment called creatively led and there might be five or six hot ones in there, then there might be three or four who are quite hot.
Yeah.
You know, you've really got one. You know, if you want one or two, you know, if you want to be a brand that gets its swagger on or whatever, how many options have you got? You know, do you see what I mean? So
yeah.
I think those ones can continue to do really well, and they almost get stronger. And in some ways, that's a good thing. Well, it is a good thing, because what you've got then is you still have a power base in that form. And it's sort of the size of it is matched to the market need of it, but it still exists in a very rich way, and brands can still access that if they need it. It can be taught if it's needed. There's a place to go. It's just at a relative to the past, a smaller scale with fewer better players in it.
Where do you go now, though? Because I mean, we have this section. I mean, you came to a workshop. It was called "Nobody Wants to Work for You," right? And there is a site coming.
What a depressing time.
It's true. It's a thing. Okay, we called it "Nobody Wants to Work for You" because that ad land that you spoke about at the beginning of this podcast, in our eyes, doesn't exist anymore. You haven't got harems of creative people, queuing outside BBH or Wyden's, desperate to be just looked at by someone and please can I come in and be part of the party. There are so many options now for any person that has a creative or strategic brain. How do agencies, or how do creative businesses, we'll call them, make themselves more attractive and desirable for those people? And what do you think has irreversibly changed in agencies?
Let's look at the positive first. Like the industry still represents, I don't even want to really call it an industry. I think even that's kind of all the industry. There's this place where you can make, there are a number of marketing communications groups. They're really big. They're by and large pretty cash rich. And they are still the only places you can go as a person coming into the working world where you can get paid to be creative. And pretty pure creative. It's not like, well, creative by what we merely mean is buying media, or what we really mean is analyzing. No, you know, it really is you can get paid to come up with stuff. And I think that's still unique, completely unique in that respect. There's no other disciplines that require it to that extent. Possibly maybe some of the innovation side, you know, certainly not management consulting in the same, you know, those the other consulting type, you know, industries you can go into. So I think sort of in a way, like the more you embrace that and to go, okay, well, net, we are still a place where you can come in, open a pad, power up a laptop, think of stuff and take a check at the end of the month. Now, maybe what could push that further is to really settle down the disciplines a little bit and be like, okay, we're for all, you know, all creative people, really. We're just a gang of creative people, actually. And the idea that then there's these, you know, there's this little group here, which we can't really afford all of them now. And oh God, are we going to do that? We've got this group and they're doing that. Maybe if it was just one big gang, it would be easier to almost be more open creatively. And for the networks which make up the rump of the jobs to be able to find the efficiencies that they need as well. So that I think there's no getting around it. It gets more consolidated at the creative end of things, the pure creative end of things. But maybe through then going, well, okay, well, why doesn't the gang of creative people a bit bigger? Weirdly, we can almost expand the playing field whilst at the same time sort of almost reducing it. Like take out the, you know, what's, it's easier to take out admin now from the business of advertising than ever. You know, you'd need layers of things just moving materials around, you know, whole account teams moving things around. You need whole production departments moving things around or whatever that might be. Those things aren't as needed anymore. And so maybe that's where we can, you know, almost like, okay, let's keep reducing the admin line almost and keep trying to pour that into the creative line. And then I think it's about, and I don't know how much the industry still does this, is sort of preaching the past. You know, I think the message has got to be, it's creative, it's open, you get paid to come up with stuff, kind of over to you.
Yeah.
Take us to the future. Like, take us, just come up with, do cool stuff. Like, and let's see where it bubbles up and let's see where it goes. Because really the great, you know, even in the purest advertising agency terms, TV, when TV was a really powerful, all-dominant channel, the creativity in those buildings was really just a massive feeling of openness and that anything could happen.
Mm.
It wasn't really, I can write TV scripts or I'm brilliant. There was a bit of that there. But they just had this tremendous creative energy. And I think that's probably what, and I think that's got to do with you know, that where we started at the beginning of this conversation, is kind of like the possibility to live into is people are still going to require people to come up with stuff. It's still, the world needs content and it needs ideas and it needs fresh thinking, really let's relax that we might get judged by the last campaign we put out, that, you know, we might need to fill the shelf with awards because it's very difficult to prove the value of what we're doing and so on and so forth. And just go, we're going to be a big creative system. Now, where does that go? And try to run that for like 2 to 3 years, if you can, against the, you know, the sort of efficiency pressures of this channel and that channel and those kinds of things. I think that's the, that's probably the way in which it maintains its uniqueness, its completely unique skill.
Would you come into this industry now? If you were 21 years old right now, you're as smart as you are, you're even more creative, right? Because I guess you didn't identify as a creative per se.
Yeah.
If you were a strategic creative 21-year-old right now, where would you go?
It's difficult because I've kind of been in the industry, and so it's easy for me to go, careful, don't, you know, there are other more lucrative jobs. My concern, I guess, for people coming into it is, where does it go? You know, where is the trajectory for them? Is it giving them skills that they could take somewhere else? Is it what, you know, what does eventual success look like? I'm less clear on those things, partly because I'm not on the inside of those networks and what they kind of offer. But on the flip side, I would go, look, if you like writing, paint, you know, I was in a fantastic call yesterday, and we were chatting about something and development of ID and growth and a bunch of sort of marketing and ad stuff. And there's a UX designer in the meeting from a brand partner side, based out in Guatemala, really cool guy called Emmy. And he just suddenly, towards the end of the meeting, went, hey guys, do you want to see something? I said, yeah, sure. And he sort of flipped the camera over, and he was in the middle of drawing an elephant. It's beautiful ink. I mean, oh my gosh, this thing, it was like, oh wow. And that was completely normal as part of that interaction. And I think we all just felt, oh, that's kind of, yeah, that makes sense. People can spin around their cameras and kind of sort of show something else that they're doing. And so I guess what I'm saying is, I think it still offers that openness.
Mm.
And so if you are an artist, or you're kind of over there and you'd like, you know, to have like a slightly steadier paycheck and to apply yourself to problem solving, and apply yourself into where big business smashes those things, that's great. Maybe just on our side, it's just a little bit more camera sort of flipping around and like, oh yeah, put that on the wall and to kind of see where that goes.
I like that. That's optimistic. It's nice.
Yeah.
I was expecting you to say, in your like Scott Galloway way, that this is all burning, leave, and everyone, you know, should run for the hills and join TikTok or whatever.
Well, I do feel that. I feel that as well, but I then can't come up with another answer. And then you kind of go, well, okay, well, why don't we look at the answer we've got then? Because I guess the best answer I've got as an alternative is, okay, well, the platforms are available to you. Go create for yourself. Put it out there in any form you like. Build your brand as your own business. And it's you, the creative thinker, that can deploy in all sorts of ways. I also have my own content. I have my own products. I have my own whatever it might be. But I know that doing that, despite the channels being available, despite the opportunities there, it's incredibly difficult to make it financially viable.
Yeah.
And so if the end game is sort of economic security for creative minds, then I don't know if it's, there are some can find it there,
yeah.
But not everyone. And the size at which the marcoms industry still offers that is still pretty big. I think the teaching schools are good. But what I wouldn't do is go, hey, great, I'm going to go to an ad school, learn how to write ads, then I'm going to obey all the ad people, and then I'm going to hopefully get the chance to make a TV script. And hopefully then if I do that, I'll get there. I think that's probably the thing that needs relaxing. It's like, no, we just want really creative people to come in. Some are going to do that. Some are going to do some other stuff. And then some other stuff's going to happen that we don't even know what it is yet. And let's let that loose within the frameworks of, you know, marketing still needs great, inspiring content. It needs fantastic design. It needs brilliant words, you know. Yeah. A lot of what we see coming through now that are incredibly helpful, people almost like poets, you know, because they just got music around words, an eye for design, you know, that kind of thing.
That's a really good answer. I'm going to quickly have to move you on to the weird part of this podcast, where we all get naked.
It's weird enough already.
Fair enough. Okay, Stinky Fish, did you read this on the cool sheet?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, did it make sense?
It did. I struggled with it with a bit because it's like, what do you hate? And I try not to hate things. It's a really painful emotion, hate.
Okay.
So I guess you don't mean that. You mean like something that we can improve.
Well,
like,
yeah, something we can improve. What frustrates you? What would you kind of put in the room at 101 box? You know, I'd put in, you know, Trump. Or you know, someone like that. Very easy, but much more creatively focused.
Oh, it's got to be creative for the sort of creative industry.
It could be a word, it could be a term, it could be anything that you like.
Yeah, I mean, I think letting go is a good vibe. Like, I think when I don't see agencies or creative companies let go of the past, I think that's a big limiting thing. So sometimes when I see, oh, you know, this happened then, and we've got to take it back to this, and this is how that was done, and in some ways, all the sort of industry paraphernalia, there's a lot of bodies, there's a lot of, you know, conferences and all this sort of stuff. And I see some of it kind of really just limiting the space in which forward, you know, progress can be made. And that's really the big thing, is this constant innovator's dilemma problem, which is, this is the thing today which throws off all the cash, and this is the thing tomorrow that we don't quite yet know. And how do we get from there to there? You know, Blockbusters doesn't go out of business because it doesn't see streaming coming. It can't rewire its revenue into the future, and that, you know, can you raise capital, that's kind of thing. And I think that every time you go, well, the way it should be done is, and you kind of try to teach it the way it was, you're almost making it harder then to let go of that kind of thing. So I think, I suppose, if I was to be down on something, it's a lack of letting go of.
What
you've got to kill your idols, like kill the. There's been some amazing moments, but incredible things. Learn the history, I think. Know the history; it all teaches you where it's going. But don't hold on to it. I think don't hold on to it as like something we've got to get back to, or that we've got to sort of reinstate. And I do hear a bit of that language, and I think then the other part of it, which goes with that, is a real inner sense of loss of value to the client partners that they're serving. So I see a lot of thanking, you know, like, thank you for letting us make this, and thank you to this brave client. You know, you're kind of like, oh my gosh, that's really endemic, I think, of the, you know, the sort of, you know, almost like an abusive relationship between, you know, we've got this, on the one hand, I'm going to do this for you, but only if you can let me do this other thing over here. And thank you so much, you know, for letting us do this. Like, oh, let's get together. Let's sit the same side of the table. Let's go on a journey together. Let's maybe get some of that stuff over there and put it in the middle. You know, so I think when those languages go out, and I see those sorts of things going out on to promote, I actually think there's a lot of limiting self-beliefs in a lot of that stuff.
Wow, that's so, really, yeah. That was a strong answer.
Too heavy.
No. I love it. I think it's what we were looking for, right? I think I can feel Ian on my left. I can feel him saying
it's
to me,
like, you guys were
job.
Late.
Yeah. What the
you were
fuck?
Chatting downstairs for too long.
But thank you, actually. Although I'm not meant to say it, I should just say, hey, thanks for sitting on the park bench with me and talking about stuff.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
But that was really, really helpful and incredible. And I think having your optimistic view that you do on an industry that no longer, I guess, controls your ego,
yeah.
You can look at it very objectively and say, hey, it's actually a great place to be part of. And I think the evolution of what's coming is really exciting. Just don't hold on to the past, and it'll be an enjoyable ride.
Yeah, let's go for that. I've learned something too in this lesson. Thank you for the therapy session.
Oh, thank you.
Wonderful. I'm going to lie down now and
okay.
breathe for 5 minutes.